publishing business for a long time, haven't you?
Oh, God, yes.
Now, how did it all start for you?
It doesn't seem like a long time. When I was in college, back in the 1940s, it simply didn't occur to me that at the end of this you had to go to work. I thought it would continue that way forever. And then one day, I think it was the year that after I'd been to graduate school for a year, I found myself with an apartment that I'd rented for the summer with some friends, all of whom left, and left me with the bill for it. And I had no way to pay for that. So I said, I think I'll go to work for a little while, a week or two, I thought. And since I had no idea what to do or what work was, but I did know something about books. I'd been reading them, after all, for 5 years in college and graduate school. I thought I'd find some work that had to do with books. And someone suggested I could be a publisher. I didn't quite know what that meant. But I looked in the yellow pages under publishers and started out with one that began with A, Apple and Century, and went all the way back down to Viking. When someone at Viking told me that Doubleday had a training program for potential publishers and that I might look into it, and I did, and I went to work there thinking I'd work for a couple of weeks. And I still think that.
You think? Well, I think you have some empirical evidence that it's not going to end in the near future.
Well, you always hope it will somehow, but it never seems to. One thing leads to another, and something's always coming up.
Yeah, I was looking over some of the bio information here, and it seems that you always have new projects and new ideas and new things to develop.
Well, those projects, now that I look back on them, starting with anchor books that I did when I was just a kid at Doubleday back in the 50s, which was the first line of so-called quality paperback books, that is, the first series of paperbacks that included not simply popular fiction and nonfiction, but more or less permanent books.
They were trade paperbacks.
Trade paperbacks, they came to be called, because they were sold through bookstores mainly rather than through newsstands. And on to the New York Review of Books, which was a rather more serious book review periodical than we were used to getting in those days, and so forth. I found that I did most of these things really to please myself, to provide myself with the books I wanted and the kind of book review I wanted, and so forth. I would get restless that certain things didn't exist in the world as they should exist, I thought. So rather than complain, I would try to make them exist.
Well, you were in the training program at Doubleday.
I was.
Yeah. When you was this like a six-month program or what? How did it
work? No one knew quite what it was. It was an idea that someone in the personnel department had. And like all such ideas, it was not very well thought out. And I was the second person hired in the training program. The first had been fired by the time I got there. So I was the entire training program as of that moment. And they couldn't very well fire me without admitting there was something wrong with the idea of a training program. I was supposed to work in various departments of the company and didn't really want to. First of all, I wasn't planning to stay. But I was wrong about that. I was arrogant. I really should have worked in different departments of the company. I would have learned something. But I wanted to stay in the editorial department where I started out, and so I did. And from that job in the editorial department, I did learn different parts of the company, because what you do in a business like that, maybe in all businesses, is use your base, mine happened to be with the editorial department, to find out how books are produced, how they're sold, how they're distributed, how they're billed, and so forth. So I did learn the whole business, but from that perch rather than going from place to place.
It seems to me that when you entered publishing, which was, I guess, late 1950s,
mid-1952.
As you said, it was an accident that you got into it, and I believe that probably was the case over many years. But now I understand that many universities actually have publishing training programs in the colleges.
I guess they do. I don't think you can. I think the best way to learn about publishing is to do it. But I'm not sure it's a business that I would recommend now to a young person. It's different from what it was when I was a kid. And I don't think nearly as much fun. It's much more challenging. It's much more difficult. But whereas when I was a young publisher, there were several hundred small to large independent bookstores throughout the country, many of which had very complex inventories of books. And were run by people who cared a lot about books and knew about books, with whom you could talk if you're an editor and tell them about what you're publishing and why you think it's important. Now there are relatively few of these independent bookstores in the country. And what there are instead is a lot of chain bookstores, mostly in shopping malls, and they're really run centrally. Their inventory is computerized. There's really no way to get to them, and they tend to sell mostly bestsellers. They pay so much rent for their space in those shopping malls that they really have to function pretty much like fast food places or any other stores in shopping malls. They have to turn inventory over very rapidly, and that means mostly bestsellers. And that's what youngsters in the business are now confronted with. A relatively few first-class independent bookstores, and then an industry otherwise dominated by these chains with their voracious demand for bestsellers and for little else. So it creates a problem.
Can't that also be said about the publishing industry?
Well, the industry follows the marketplace. Yeah. The marketplace determines the shape of everything else in the industry. And ultimately, it determines not just how the publishers behave, but how the writers themselves behave. Because a writer who wants to write a serious book and thinks it will take him 10 or 15 years to do it or whatever, and often does take that long, may think twice if he sees that there really isn't much chance of his reaching his potential market through the available independent bookstores that are likely to carry his perhaps esoteric book. So he may decide not to write it at all, or the publisher may decide not to finance it for him. So finally, this situation that begins with a kink in the marketplace, and this is nobody's fault, and the people who run these chains are nice people, I know them and they're friends, but they have no choice. They have to pay that rent, therefore they need those bestsellers, and they can't afford to carry much else. This reflects back through the publishers to the writers themselves, and some books are not going to get written. Other books that will get written simply won't see the light of day for more than, well, I think it was Calvin Trillin, the essayist, who said a while ago that a book's shelf life now is somewhere between milk and yogurt. Mm-hmm. There simply isn't enough space out there.
3 months, I think, the average shelf life is.
Something like that.
Yeah. Let's work up to the Reader's Catalog and tie this in, but just to go back a little bit, a moment ago you said that you wouldn't recommend young people going into publishing today. I was reading Publishers Weekly last week, and I saw the profile of salaries in the industry. And I've talked to a lot of people about why they go into it. Richard Merrick sat where you were sitting, and I asked him about salaries, and he said, well, we don't pay very well. And he himself has not been paid very well. He's doing all right now over at Dutton, of course. I said, well, why do people want to go in? He said, because it's such a wonderful industry. It's a wonderful thing to do. Isn't that really why people want to do it more than anything else?
Of course that's why people want to do it, and that's why they always have done it. That's why I did it. You don't go into this business hoping to make money. You can't. There is no money in this business to speak of. I mean, you get paid a fair wage, but compared to what you can make in Wall Street or in a law firm, it's trivial. You're never going to end up with a BMW and a house in East Hampton in this business. And
well,
you shouldn't think about it.
Some publishers do. Some publishers do quite well. It's the staff, the line people who seem to have the hard time.
Well, I suppose the senior people, the owners of the companies, do pretty well. But it's a tough business, and you don't go into it to make money. You go into it for other reasons, because you care about books, because you think books are the most important thing in the world. That without them, there wouldn't, in effect, be no world. You go into it because you somehow know that everything we know through books. We know our language, our history, ourselves, our nature, our universe, through books, and pretty much only through books. But because of this distortion in the marketplace that, as I say again, is nobody's fault, where publishers have to concentrate on bestsellers, and there's nothing wrong with bestsellers, but to publish them, to concentrate on them at the expense of everything else, makes a rather dull career for a young person whose tastes may be very eccentric or eclectic or widespread, but who finds that he simply can't devote the time and energy and the capacities of his company to support these so-called minor books, or mid-list books, as we sometimes call them. And it can be very frustrating.
Well, you've tried to get around that dilemma with the Reader's Catalog. Let's talk about that now. That's the real reason you're here. I was going through this book, and it's absolutely fascinating. The area I know best, of course, is 20th century literature, especially the newer writers, because with the broadcasts that I've been doing for the last 15 or 20 years, almost all of the writers in there I've talked to. It's been a wonderful chance to talk to them and just to look at their books. First of all, you knew that there were problems with regard to marketing these books in the bookstores, so you got this idea for the Reader's Catalog. But what exactly is it supposed to do?
Well, what the Reader's Catalog is supposed to do is make available to every reader in his own home the equivalent of an ideal bookstore. Some people in this country who live near the handful of first-rate independent bookstores know what it's like to walk into a bookstore that has everything that you could possibly want and much else besides. It's a thrilling experience. You never want to leave those places. But alas, there are only a handful of such stores in the entire country, maybe 50, maybe 60, maybe 100, who knows. Depending upon how you define it, maybe as many as 200, but that's about it. Otherwise, people are pretty much limited to what they can find in the shopping malls, and those inventories are going to be pretty thin. So I try to think of a way to make available to everybody in this country what is in fact now available only to a handful of people who live near these wonderful bookstores, most of which happen not to be in major cities where the rents are too high for them to exist. They happen to be there in places like Ann Arbor, or one is in Denver, one is up in the middle of the woods in Vermont, and so forth. So I try to recreate the experience of being in such a bookstore in the form of a catalog from which people could order books by telephone or mail or fax, or in fact go to a local bookstore and even if it didn't have these books in stock, at least know what to ask for so that the local store could order them for them.
Well, can't the reader do that through books in print? Most bookstores carry that.
Well, books in print, first of all, is extremely unwieldy and not very accurate. And it's not designed for people to read, much less to take home with them and read. It's really a reference book, a rather imprecise reference book, I should say, for bookstores and libraries to use themselves. What the Reader's Catalog is a reader-friendly, let's say, version of something like books in print. But it's really a book from which a reader can learn just by looking through it, about American literature or American history.
You've organized it much the way a bookstore would organize its stock.
Well, we try to organize it exactly like a bookstore, with 208 categories, or as they would be in a bookstore, 208 departments, covering all the fields of human knowledge and entertainment. And we tried in as many ways as we could to reproduce the actual experience of being in a bookstore. Of course, you can't really do that in the form of a catalog, but we try to imagine this catalog as the equivalent of a knowledgeable and friendly clerk at your elbow explaining what these books are, showing you excerpts from them, showing you how a subject like literary criticism or modern British poetry lays itself out, what the important subcategories are to look for, who the major figures, the minor figures are, what the trends are in these categories. It's an extraordinary reference book, I think.
Oh, I think so, too. Is this book designed for a person, a reader, to purchase and take home and keep on his shelf, or is it aimed primarily for the reader who walks into a bookstore?
Well, it goes both ways. It's aimed mainly at people who want to buy it in the bookstore, take it home, read it at home, begin to understand the major categories of human knowledge insofar as those are revealed through books in a convenient way, and then go to their bookstores and order the books or call up our own 800 number and order them that way. But it's also a special edition produced in cooperation with the Reader's Catalog by the American Booksellers Association, which booksellers themselves will keep on their counters so the customers coming into the bookstores can look through this book. It's a more efficient, as I said before, it's a more efficient books in print, and order the books right through the bookstores. The difference between that edition and the one you take home with you is a sturdier binding, because the one in the bookstore is going to take more abuse, obviously, heavy plastic binding, and it does not include our 800 number. You order the books from that ABA version, of this catalog directly through the bookstore.
Now, where are all these books stored? They're all different publishers?
Well, that was one of the great problems we had to face before we could think of beginning such a complex project as this. There is a wholesaler named Baker & Taylor, the largest book wholesaler in the world, and he happens to be no farther away than Somerville, New Jersey. And so when I first conceived this project, about 4 years ago, I went to the people at Baker & Taylor and said, if I do this, will you back me up? Will you stock every book that I put in the catalog? And they said they would, and that's what they've done. So every book in the catalog now exists at Baker & Taylor. And all I have to do when a customer calls me and orders a book is refer that order back to Baker & Taylor. From there, it's sent to a warehouse of my own up in Pennsylvania, and then off to the customer who asks for it, all within 4 or 5 days, if all goes well. Booksellers can do the same thing. They can now call Baker & Taylor and find all the books listed in the reader's catalog on Baker & Taylor's shelves, and they can satisfy their customers more efficiently than they could have before all this happened.
What about the cost difference if a reader orders a book through the 800 number or writes for it, and or if he goes into the bookstore? Is there any difference in the cost?
There'll be a shipping and handling charge, for customers who order the book through my 800 number or who special order it through bookstores. Bookstores also charge a little extra for special orders. Otherwise, the price is the same. I did not want to discount any of the prices in this catalog because I do not want to compete that way with retail bookstores. I want to do everything I can to support retail bookstores.
The bookstores, though, get their standard, what is 40%, right?
They get discounts ranging upward from 40% to 46%, depending upon the quantity that they buy.
But it would be in your interest, then, however, to have the reader order directly by the phone.
It would be, but if we're going to sustain this catalog over several editions, they're going to have to do that to some extent because that's what will support the business. But I want to be very, very clear that my interest here is in making books available as widely as possible to as many people as possible, as great a selection of them, and I would be delighted to see that happen through bookstores as much as to see it happening through my own resources.
What kind of reaction have you had from the bookstores?
On the whole, very positive. Some booksellers see it as competitive. Most booksellers see it as a stimulus, which will encourage people to come in and buy more books than ever before from them. And I'm sure those booksellers are right. I hope, and I just know in my bones, this is going to make people buy many, many more books than they otherwise would. And I base this partly on the experience of some of these wonderful independent bookstores that I've been talking about here, whose owners find that the more titles they add to their shelves, that is, the broader their inventories become, the more categories of books they carry, and the more titles within each category that they carry, the more books they're going to sell. And they're always surprised, these booksellers are, so they tell me, by the wide range of interests among American readers that are reflected by the sales of books out of these complex inventories. And incidentally, the smaller the proportion of bestsellers will be with the total sale of books, if you can broaden your inventory sufficiently.
Now, Jeffrey O'Brien is the editor of the Reader's Catalog. This was a major mammoth job to select all these books. What was the basic criteria in picking these particular books?
Well, we had to work that out as we did it. What Jeffrey did, and by the way, he is entirely responsible, he and his colleagues, for the editorial side of this. I did nothing more than find him, which was fortunate for me. Is to assemble groups of experts who would begin by making basic lists, and then those lists would be handed on to other people who knew the subject, and back and forth, until finally a list began to emerge that made some sense and it looked as if it were reasonably definitive. And then we had to check that against what's in print, because not every book that you want to put in the catalog is going to be available, because there are relatively so few bookstores in this country. It's hard for publishers to keep their so-called backlists in print. So that was the limiting factor, the availability of books from publishers. But the selections were really the result of endless discussions. I would go over to that office and find 6 or 8 people sitting around talking about what 17th century English poets to put in and what editions were the best ones and should what editions of Shakespeare should they use, and so on and so forth. There was an endless discussion going on for 3 years among these people. It was fascinating to overhear it.
Well, new books come out all the time. How are you going to keep the reader's catalog current?
We're going to put the catalog itself in a database. That is, right now it's on floppy disks, but by the middle of November it will all be on one CD. And we will update it every day as new books come along and as older books, alas, go out of print. By the time the catalog is, say, 10% different from what it is now, and that may be a year or 14 months from now, we'll print a new edition from that continuously revised database.
How about a supplement?
We will probably, in fact, we will issue monthly or bi-monthly bulletins in various categories as people ask for them. So there'll only be the catalog itself and the revision every year or 18 months, let's say. But throughout the intervening months between each edition of the catalog, there will be bulletins going to customers.
Well, if I may make a suggestion, one thing that I think would help to make this even a more valuable tool for the reader or researcher would be to have the date of the book.
We do have the dates in some categories. Political books and topical books especially, we do have the dates. It probably doesn't help much to have the date, let's say, of Moby Dick or Henry V or whatever. But we will in the future probably include dates. I know that Christopher Layman had in his very good review this morning in the Times mentioned that as something we should look into for the future, and we will. But we have to be careful how we do it because a date isn't relevant in every case. We have to be a little selective. But as I say, in the case of topical books, we do have the dates.
Well, I think a date is important because what if you are a person like myself who wants to... I'm going to be interviewing Margaret Drabble this afternoon, and I would leaf through this book under English writers, modern English writers, and I would see on before me what books Margaret Drabble has written that are in print and their dates. It would be helpful to me or for anybody doing any kind of research.
I think you're right, and we'll definitely do that in future editions. No question of that.
Where does the reader obtain the reader's catalog?
Well, he can get it in his bookstore. He can get it if he belongs to the Book of the Month Club or the History Book Club or the Quality Paperback Book Club or the Reader Subscription Book Club. Get it through any of those. He can get it by calling the 800 number that's appears on the catalog and will appear in advertisements, which I can, if you want to read it, it's right in front of you now.
I mean, each bookstore, the major bookstores will be stocking this.
Oh, sure.
So people can go in.
All the major bookstores will stock this, so we can get it in any bookstore, almost any bookstore in the country.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. And I think it's also a demonstration of your love for books. There's no doubt about that. You know, a moment ago you mentioned the New York Review of Books, which you helped to found. Are you still involved in that publication?
Well, no. We sold it, the founders of it, including myself, sold it about 5 or 6 years ago to a wonderful man who now is the publisher of it. I'm still involved as a kind of alumnus, and I read it a lot and care about it. And, of course, I know the editors, one of whom is my former wife and very good friend, Barbara. And Bob Silvers. And occasionally I write for it. I'm planning to write a couple of things for it right now, if I can ever find the time. But that's really the extent of my involvement.
I love the personal ads.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hope that brought a lot of people together happily.
Didn't the New York Review of Books come out of a newspaper strike?
That began in 1963 when the Times was on strike. And there simply was no book review. As long as the strike was on. The strike, as it turned out, lasted a long time, many weeks. So we decided that we would do a book review of our own while the strike was on. And we sort of put it together on the dining room table. Asked a lot of friends if they'd write reviews for it. And my wife, Barbara, went out and sold the ads. And Bob Silvers, who was then editor at Harper's Magazine, took a leave of absence and was the editor. And we finally printed it. And we distributed it in a hit-or-miss way. We didn't know much about that at the time. And to our amazement, though we printed only 100,000 copies and certainly couldn't have distributed them all, 2,000 people wrote in and asked us to continue doing it. Well, that's a lot of people to write in and take the trouble to find our address and encourage us. So we thought, why not keep on doing it?
Well, frequently I talk to people who complain about the fact that there are so many modes of competition for books, video and computers and so forth. And yet I get the impression in reading some of the surveys I see in Publishers Weekly that people are reading more today.
Absolutely. There's no question of that. And as I said before, the more books that are made available to them, that is, the more titles that are made available to them, the more they will read, the more broadly they will read. I think that among readers in this country, and of course not everybody is a book reader, but among book readers in this country, intellectual curiosity is something we should never underestimate. Americans are avid for the kind of information they can find in books. How many such people there are, I have no idea. 2 million, 3 million, 5 million. It's anybody's guess, but it is simply extraordinary, the intellectual curiosity that these people have. And it's wonderful.
You mentioned a moment ago that some of the chain bookstores have this preoccupation with the bestsellers, kind of like fast food outlets. Random House, of course, is no stranger to bestsellers.
And how?
And yet, I read 2, 3, 4, 5 books a week, usually, and I tell you, the past year, I've read so many remarkable books from all sorts of publishing houses, and they didn't all become bestsellers, but they were wonderful, wonderful books.
Well, you prove my point, then.
Right. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that great books are still being written.
Oh, absolutely. And a book doesn't have to have been written in the last 6 months to be good, by the way. There are lots of books that people have been writing since Homer that are wonderful. I mean, I find the older I get, the older the books are that I tend to read. And it's absolutely thrilling to find all the things out that you can find out when you're involved in these. Of course, I have to read a lot of contemporary books, too, the same way you do. It's my business. But
well, I've made a mistake in the past. I'm trying to rectify it now. Whenever I found mostly fiction, my major interest, I just wouldn't throw the book out. And then books come to me in shopping bags. And so I had to rent a storage room in a warehouse to store my books and put them on a database. And now I realize that I'm not the Library of Congress or the New York Public Library. I have got to be more selective myself in what I have, and I have to go through a lot of the books and donate them to the library or whatever to do that. What do you think is going to happen in our literary horizon? What kinds of books are going to come out, and what's going to happen to the American publishing industry, especially with the way there have been so many mergers and conglomerates?
Well, I think the publishing industry is, as I said earlier, in a bit of a crisis, which is why I would not necessarily recommend it as a career for youngsters these days. I think that the over-concentration on bestsellers among publishers, an over-concentration that reflects the over-concentration in the marketplace, in the retail marketplace, which, as I said before, requires bestsellers to maintain the turnover, to pay the rent in their shopping malls, that over-concentration is very dangerous for publishers, because the shopping mall stores that concentrate on bestsellers have so amplified the sale of a bestseller over the past 10 years that the bestseller now sells, a given bestseller will sell 3 to 4 times as many copies now as it had sold at the beginning of the 1980s, simply because of the extent to which the chain bookstores and the shopping malls concentrate on these things at the expense of everything else, or much else. That means that the authors of these bestsellers, whose names are known in the shopping malls, who are in effect brand names, can really name their price and can demand of the publisher not only a guarantee against royalties, but a guarantee so large that it will include a large part of the publisher's profit. The sales of these bestsellers are so great that what's left over is often enough to keep the publisher happy. But what happens when one of these bestsellers doesn't quite make it and it flops, as some of them occasionally do totally? Then the publisher is left not only with a huge unearned advance, but with massive amounts of inventory. Because in order to satisfy the appetite of these chain stores for bestsellers, the publisher has to print, in the best circumstances, far more copies than he can ever hope to sell. So that the returns he takes, even on a successful book, might be 20-25% of the total number he shipped out. But what if the book doesn't work? Then he has the advance to write off, and he has the inventory to write off, and this can be a matter of millions of dollars. It takes a lot of books, a lot of successful books, to earn that million, those millions of dollars back. So that's the crisis that the book industry is in right now.
Well, I've noticed something. I've gone to Barnes & Noble, and I've seen last year's bestseller stacked up hundreds, if not thousands, of copies. They're all remaindered.
Well, picture this. You take a great bestseller, we'll sell 800,000 copies, maybe. To sell 800,000 copies, the publisher has to ship, let's say a million, maybe even 1,200,000 copies of that. So he's left with, even in the case of a very successful book, he's left with a remainder of 200,000 or 300,000 books. That's horrendous. If you can picture what 200,000 books looks like, it would fill an ocean liner.
I published a book last year as a novel. St. Martin's Press published it. I got a royalty statement showing that the book sold 4,800 copies or something. Theoretically, I owe them money for my advance on paper. Why did they bother to buy it and publish it?
I mean, that's what publishers are all about. That's what they like to do. That's what they mainly like to do. Anybody can publish a great best-selling author with a name known to millions. You don't have to publish those books. You just give them to the printer and mail them out and people buy them. It's books like yours that publishers care about. And they stay up all night working on them, and they hope and pray for them, and they do whatever they can to make them work because they believe in them. That's what the business is really all about. Unfortunately, we can't spend as much time doing that as we would like to.
Still, we have ended this interview on a note of optimism, and I like that. It's fascinating. There's nothing more than I like to do than to talk about books and writing. Jacob, thank you very much. I thank you.
Pleasure.
Hang on a second.